This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to The Waves for Thursday, April 11th, the Honky Tonk Padonkadonk edition. I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of the Slate podcast Outward. Joining me on today's episode is Georgetown University history professor Marcia Chatelain. Hey, Marcia.
Hi, Christina.
Marcia's actually not in D.C. with me today. She's in New York with writer and co-host of the podcast Thirst Aid Kit, Nicole Perkins. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
So we have a very happy announcement to make on this week's episode. This is our permanent lineup. Me, Marcia, Nicole, happy little trio. Occasionally we'll sub in other folks as necessary, but this is it. Welcome. We're happy to have you. This week, we're going to chat with NPR's Yowei Shaw about an Invisibilia episode she reported on how race affects sexual and romantic preferences and whether people can or should try to hack their own desires. Then we'll talk about nemeses on Twitter and in real life. And finally, we'll discuss country music and whether it's a hostile genre for female musicians. All right. And Marcia, what are we doing for Slate Plus?
For this week's Slate Plus Is It Sexist segment, we ask, is it sexist to want a fresh face in politics? And here's a sneak peek of what we talked about.
You know, he was like, you got to keep Trump, you know, someone asked him, why did he say that? And he's like, you've got to keep Trump's misogynistic followers in mind if you want to flip them.
Cool.
No,
so we're just
stop
gonna...
it. There's no more flipping.
Oh, God,
I can't. In the words of Stacey Abrams, you do not run for second place. Stop it, everyone.
Right.
Enough. So check out Slate.com/TheWavesPlus for a free 2-week trial if you aren't already a member of Slate Plus.
Before we get into the episode, I want to thank all the listeners who responded to my conversation with Mark Harris about Pete Buttigieg last week. We got a couple really thoughtful emails about it, and it's a topic that I am incredibly interested in continuing to discuss, so please continue reaching out with your thoughts. All right, let's get into it. Yowei Shaw is a senior reporter and producer at NPR's Invisibilia. On the most recent episode of the podcast titled A Very Offensive Rom-Com, she reported on one Chinese-American woman who realized she was almost exclusively sleeping with and swiping right on white men. So she decided to see if she could force her attractions to evolve and expand to include more men of color. Yowei, welcome to The Waves.
Hi.
So I loved the episode. I thought it was, you know, really searching and funny and full of heart for a topic that is incredibly difficult to talk about. In fact, you say in the episode that people would sort of cringe every time you talked to them about the reporting you were doing on how race and racism impacts dating and sex and sexual desire. So why is this topic so difficult for people to talk about?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I even cringed a little bit when you said the episode description. I was like, oof, that sounds rough. I mean, I think attraction is just such a personal and intimate thing. And I think that we don't often talk about what we're attracted to and why. And a lot of times we don't even know ourselves. Like, it just sort of happens. And so when you're talking about race and attraction, I think, you know, a lot of people can sort of, I mean, I think we all can agree, you know, like, racism is bad. and we
I don't know.
Can
Some people aren't
that,
sure about that.
That's true. But I'm just saying that, like, we can agree for the most part, hopefully, that, you know, we don't want to see discrimination, racial discrimination in these other areas like housing and schooling and the workplace. And, you know, your personal sexual life is this private sphere that is kind of that is free from outside interrogation. You know what I mean? And so I think a lot of times there's more room for people to do things that they might not want to talk about publicly. And also just not, and because we're not talking about it publicly, then it becomes really taboo, if you know what I mean.
For me, listening to that episode reminded me of something that I and my friend Bim have been doing on another podcast that we had called Thirst Aid Kit, where we looked at, you know, sometimes we get all these images that white men are the only men who are good looking. And so looking at these celebrity crushes that we have, like, is this person really cute or is he just tall and white? Mm. So the whole that episode just really like drove all of that home for me, because that is something that, you know, we talk about and we look at a lot, and we try to bring to the forefront of the discussion, you know, some men who are quite attractive but get overlooked because they're brown or, you know, whatever, or just don't get the same kind of opportunities. You know, there are a lot of Hollywood actors who should be further in their career than they are, but because they happen to be Asian or a Latino or Black or some other kind of ethnic mix, they don't necessarily get the same shot as Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise or even Chris Hemsworth or something like that.
You know, that makes me think of this this Asian actor that I talked to that didn't make it into the episode, but like, the main takeaway from that interview was, here is this, I mean, like, I don't want to be inappropriate, but like, objectively very hot.
Oh, that's not inappropriate. That's perfectly appropriate.
I like looked him up online and I was just like texting all my friends. I was like, wow. But basically, like, here's this guy who is objectively handsome and hot, and yet he told me that for most of his life, he thought he was undateable.
Wow.
Like, he just thought he was unattractive and undateable. And he told me this story about meeting up with a girlfriend, like a friend, you know, a girlfriend of his, and asking her, like, is something wrong with me? Like, do I need to work on something? And she was like, Kenny, like, no, you're fine. You're great. It just shows me the power of these racial preferences and these stereotypes, that they can warp this man's perception so much that he can't even, like, he can't even see that he's attractive.
Mm-hmm. And one of the more interesting threads in the episode has to do with an Asian American man who was so convinced that something was wrong with him in his youth that he eventually was seduced by a white supremacist ideology. Like, the forces that were telling him that he was unattractive were so strong that he was like, okay, there must actually be a scientific reason why, you know, women aren't attracted to me. Was that a surprising thread for you to find?
I mean, to find an Asian white supremacist anywhere, I think, is pretty surprising. I think he was like on the extreme end of a lot of stories from Asian men that, you know, have a similar kind of experience, and then they kind of go in different directions, like what they decide to do with those experiences and those messages that, you know, they're not attractive. Asian men are not attractive. It was very surprising. I mean, in some ways, it's not surprising that if the racial hierarchy, you feel that very, like, in your bones and in your experience and in, you know, around you in the culture. If you see that, if you're a young person, you know, it's not that surprising that you would try to find a reason for that. And there's a whole, you know, there's a variety of different explanations for that. And one being, you know, explanations that justify that those, you know, that hierarchy that you're experiencing.
Yaoi, thank you so much for this piece. I teach a class called Sex, Love, and Race in American Life and Culture, and now I have something new to assign students. But one of the things that I think is interesting to think about, and I'm wondering if this came up in your reporting, is the fact that, you know, Asian American is such a complicated category because, you know, pan-Asian identity is hard to pin down because people are coming from so many different places. But with that being said, do you feel like some of the people you interviewed had these very clear distinctions between people you date versus people you marry? Because I do wonder if some of these complicated issues about attraction are also tied to ideas of social mobility. So like white supremacy is so internalized that we imagine, you know, picking a white partner as access to power or a kind of fitting in. Mm. And at the same time, among immigrant communities of a number of backgrounds, this issue of out marriage versus in marriage really complicates, I think, the ways that people think about potential partners. And so I'm curious if people made those distinctions.
I think that, well, that's definitely something I heard from people in my reporting as one of the reasons. It's hard to know why you do things sometimes, right? Like, it's like, why do I, if you look back at your romantic trajectory, it's like, well, why do I have these patterns if there is a pattern? And it's, the factors are so complicated, and it's hard to sort of analyze backwards, and even in the moment, probably. Those reasons of, you know, wanting to assimilate or wanting to fit in or wanting to get certain, you know, privileges or to, you know, fit in with white society, that stuff definitely came up. But I think it was still hard for people to really come to a conclusive conclusion about it, because I think it is, because there are so many factors that go into attraction and why you decide to date or marry someone, that it's just really, it's kind of impossible to entangle.
I was thinking about how online dating has affected these sorts of, you know, social forces. I mean, in part, the reason why we're able to have these conversations with some like data backing it up is because of online dating, because, you know, OkCupid releases all of this information about how often people respond to Black women and how often like white women respond to men of color. And on the other hand, I think things like Tinder have encouraged a kind of like split second decision making that maybe, you know, meeting people IRL would negate. Then again, like because of online dating, people might be exposed to more people outside of their social circles in real life. I mean, I don't have any like conclusions to draw away from this, but it seems to me that as people, as more and more relationships start online, you know, they're like these trends might be either exacerbated or change in some way.
I do wonder sometimes about the way that apps can fool us into thinking that our world is bigger than it actually is. Because I think about in the very moment in which the social barriers to interracial relationships are lowering, we have these mechanisms to narrow who our potential partners are. And so I think about this a lot in terms of thinking about what does it mean when these mechanisms help us do the filtering that segregated social life does in real life, right? So I'm always so cautious about making any assumptions that when more time passes, people become more open in their ability to cross those boundaries. I do wonder if sometimes with dating apps, part of the comfort of the use of the app is not having to feel accountable to any of these choices, right? So it's a fix-up.
Because you're just being led by your heart.
Or your preferences can just be between you and the app. And mind you, I'm 100 years old. And so I dated and got married before apps got good. So this is really just a I know. It's like I didn't. Yeah.
I think you didn't miss anything.
I got married before the iPhone. So, you know, so as a result, dating IRL is kind of all I know. And I felt like I was more open, but I don't have enough of a scientific basis. So let me not make conjecture fact. But all of this is to say that I do think that I do wonder if apps are another filtering mechanism that social class, college education, social life, it's an extension of that rather than a disruption of it. But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, on Tinder, one of the very few pieces of information you can put on the app that they'll show you right away is like, where did you go to college or did you go to college?
And a lot of times, in my experience, the guys will just, you know, sometimes they'll say the School of Hard Knocks or some ridiculously corny thing like that to kind of avoid that. And there are a lot of ways that people try to avoid giving that information up because they strictly just want you to go off of their pictures and that's it. You know, they don't want, also speaks to maybe the reason why they're there, right? They're not there for anything deep or lasting. They just want, you know, this very superficial kind of experience, which is fine, whatever. Everybody has their thing. But for me, I found that dating apps, when it comes to white men approaching me, at least, it did make them bolder, right? Because they are not in a public space. And so no one is judging them when they go to talk to someone who is not white. Hmm. Right. Then they also become bolder in the racist and ridiculous things that they say, you know, like, hey, brown sugar, mm-hmm. I like me some chocolate, that kind of thing.
So they're unlike.
So while like in person, yikes, they may not say that because they will get an immediate, like, face-to-face physical kind of reaction right. from that. But right. in the apps, it does I think they are emboldened.
I do remember back in, I sound so old. Back in my day, I do think that when people were interested in someone of a different race, there was a desire to collect intel if they were open to it.
Right.
And I remember social situations where people would have dinner and they're like, do you think so-and-so would date a white guy? And there was like this kind of level of checking before people were introduced to each other. And I do think the apps kind of clear that one level.
Hmm. Well, it seems like there's also, like, we make, like, someone made this really good point about how we are making all these choices in, I mean, sometimes it's not really a choice, but like where we live, where we work, who our friends with, like we're structuring our lives in all these ways that limit our exposure to different kinds of people or certain kinds of people. And so it's like the online dating platform does allow you to cross those boundaries at a much lower cost. Rather than like, I'm going to like go out and like meet an entire different group of people that I've never hung out with before, which I think can be, you know, that is like one of the liberating things about this, about online dating. Of course, there's so many terrible things as well.
And if I could just make one compliment of your podcast, it was so well researched and I love that there was so much history in it. And
Me too.
Recommend a reading to the people who loved it as much as I did. There's a book called Thinking Orientals, Migration, Contact, and Exoticism in Modern America by a scholar named Henry Yu. And there's a section about it, about this woman named Emma Fong Kuno, who married both a Chinese man and his Japanese like friend after he died. And it was about how a lot of the article or a lot of the chapter is about how obsessed people were with her relationship. Like she would publish these stories in newspapers in the early 20th century because there was an obsession with a white woman married to an Asian man. And so in some ways, I think a lot of what you're tracing is this like this deeply rooted fascination with interracial relationships, especially among white people and Asian Americans, that is all about kind of sorting out ideas about difference in sexuality. And I just love how you touched upon that.
Thank you. That sounds like a really, I wish I had read that book for my research. I feel like, well, one thing that didn't make it in the episode, a point that Russell Robinson told me that I think was really valid, was that, you know, we do have this fascination with interracial relationships and kind of this scrutiny, like interracial relationships are under more scrutiny than same-race relationships. And his point was that the dynamics that operate in a same-race relationship might be, you know, the same. Or like what he's saying is like same-race relationships, like the people in those relationships, they might be, have racial preferences themselves that are based on racial stereotypes. And so he doesn't think that it's really, you know, useful to scrutinize interracial relationships more than same-race relationships necessarily. Like, oh, there's something going on if there's an interracial relationship. He really doesn't believe that. And I think that's useful to remember.
I want to ask you guys, so the title of the episode, A Very Offensive Rom-Com, is a phrase that you use in the episode, Yowei, because the person's experiment, you know, where she decided she was only going to set her filters to see men of color and only really try to date men of color, that idea was offensive. I have to say, I did not find it offensive. I thought, like, I kind of wish more people took such intentional, like, I don't want to say experiments, although I guess it is an experiment, but like intentionally tried to think about who they were dating and why, and maybe tried to like go outside their so-called comfort zone. Did you genuinely find it offensive, Yowei? And Nicole and Marsha, I'm curious to hear what you guys think too.
Yeah, I'm very curious to hear what you think. I think there are parts of Elle's experiment that are offensive. So I think, you know, the way you laid it out right there, the intention of like, you know, intentionally exposing yourself to new kinds of people and, you know, trying to maybe see if you can discover new attractions. I don't think that's offensive, but I think that there are definitely parts of the story that are cringeworthy and are offensive. And I heard from, you know, I talked to so many people about this story along the way to get their feedback. And one thing that I heard from men of color was like, they were offended that she had such a hard time being attracted to men of color in the first place. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think there is some kind of like baked into the premise of her experiment is kind of this offensive idea that like, oh, are men of color less attractive? Or like, why is it so hard for you to be attracted to us?
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think the experiment was offensive. Along those same lines of it's important to that we all just kind of explore who and what we're attracted to, and that we give ourselves room and permission to do that exploration. And that just because someone told us at one point that blonde hair and blue eyed is the end all be all, that we push back against that and look look for ways to explore beyond that. So I don't think that's offensive. And I do understand that feeling, though, of trying to figure out, well, what's so terrible about us that you have to force yourself to look at us in a different way. But I do wonder if Elle could kind of just stop calling it an experiment now and just kind of move on, you know, because,
yeah,
you know, she mentioned the relationship that she was in. And I think this was Elle, and that she admitted to him that she started dating men of color to prove something to herself or whatever. And, you know, he didn't run away screaming, but it did remind me very much of those teen rom-coms where the jock dates the nerdy girl as a bet and then they fall in love. And then, you know, it comes out that it was a bet and, you know, the nerdy girl is destroyed and everything. So it made me think of that, which is just, you know, it's kind of immature, I guess, a little bit. But I think I don't think you need to keep calling it an experiment, and you're still just dating at this point.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And the word experiment, now that you mention it, Nicole, it does inherently have a connotation of like, I'm trying out this sort of exotic thing just for a while before I go back to the thing that I actually like.
Right. Right. And that's the thing. Like, if there is no progress, if you're just like, let me just see what these guys are about, but I know that I'm always going to go back to this particular guy, I think that, you know, maybe she would have gone into the experiment. I can't call it anything else, but into this
program
dating, process, you know, biased already, right? But it sounds like she was open and open to changing her whole dating life from it.
Oh, so
I love the world weary sigh that you started that with.
So I think that one of the reasons why people are fascinated with interracial relationships, and this I get from many scholars, so I didn't come up with this, is this idea that like people aren't sure if it represents the ability to overcome boundaries or if it's just a representation of how deep boundaries are. And so when we looked into interracial relationships to soothe our ideas about structural changes, we lose sight that at the end of the day, these are individual relationships that can operate in a number of ways. And so I guess my concern about any type of experiment, I love the idea of using flooding of images as a way to decolonize one's perceptions and attractions. But because I'm me, I always wonder then what's the pivot to things that are political and like largely structural. And so part of, I think, what happens in some relationships across racial boundaries is that a person could lose capital. They could become more alienated from their families and friends and community, and they take that risk because they believe in that individual relationship. And so I want people to like harness that energy and then like vote for good candidates in 2020 and like look for local level reforms for taxes so that people have enough to eat and healthcare and schools. Like I just, part of my concern always is when we use these personal relationships as illustrative of social change, that you don't lose sight that like there's lots of stuff to change. And so I appreciate when someone is saying, okay, I'm going to be really thoughtful about some of these messages I've received. And then, you know, is the conclusion then, oh, and I met someone really hot and I got to date them, and so I've just upped the number of hot people who go out with me? Or, wow, this has really helped me challenge the people in my community who have reified this ideas of like white supremacy and attraction. And now I feel a little bit better equipped to challenge them and then to like look at my own internalized and externalized racism and cut it out.
Yeah, the personal is political, always. But also the political is political.
Right. I wanted to go back to the episode, the science of the episode with the rats experiment and the vests.
Sure.
Because I was really fascinated by that because I know I have a particular physical preference when it comes to dating men that doesn't have anything to do with race. And
it has to do with vests, doesn't it?
It has to do with Prince imprinted on me when I was very young. So to see this experiment or to hear about this experiment where the rats just were not getting down because they didn't have the vests on and that's what they were used to being with, that kind of struck me. And I wondered if you, Yoe, had any other examples in talking to people about them realizing, oh, this was the moment that changed the shape of my desire.
I just want to make clear that like this theory of the primacy of first experiences, I think it can feel scary and determinative to people. You know, like you think back to your first experiences and you're like, oh no, what if I didn't, you know, how, like, I don't want that to be like shaping all of my preferences. And I just want to say first that, you know, the level of conditioning that happens is really like changes from person to person and how, you know, what your experiences go on to look like after that first experience and so many other things. I think that like from talking to researchers about this question of like, can you change your racial preferences? Like, and how would you do it? There's no research about the question, about this particular question, but it seems like, you know, this idea of like a happy accident kept coming up, that like if you were to just happen to have a pleasurable sexual experience with a new kind of person, then that experience can trigger all of the same processes in your brain that then make you start to pay attention to those traits in the future. And that's something that I heard from people when talking to them.
I know we have to wrap up, but I just want to say in the episode, you say, you know, we shouldn't try to extrapolate or be wary of extrapolating these sorts of arguments and science onto sexual orientation. But my own experience, I feel like a lot of this is true for my experience. After dating and sleeping with men for a long time, and I had like hooked up with women and whatever, but it really took like one specific person for me who I was like extraordinarily attracted to and had an amazing time with for me to be able to envision my life actually being partnered with women. And then I was like, you know, certain random qualities that she had were like the beginnings of my attractions, like women who wear baseball hats or like the randomest stuff where it was like, I felt like a rat in a vest who had like imprinted on another rat in a vest or whatever, like that experiment. I highly recommend the Invisibilia episode to our listeners. It'll just hopefully open up new realms of thought for your own understandings of attraction. Yowei, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a really great conversation.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
All right, listeners, let us know what you think. Have you thought about the racial makeup of your dating history? Have you made a concerted effort to change it ever? You can email us at thewaves@slate.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Next up, nemesis. Marcia, tell us what it means to have a nemesis and why we're talking about it.
Well, I've had one since high school. No, just kidding. So if you are one of the 583,000 people who follow Roxane Gay, then you know that part of the writer and cultural critics' tweeting patterns includes a reference to several nemeses that she has. And it has, I think, sparked a trend across Twitter where people subtly or not so subtly make references to their nemesis. And so the past few weeks, we've had different think pieces pondering whether or not it is healthy and normal, an asterisk on the word normal, to have someone who you hold in slight contempt but are deeply inspired by, whether it's their level of productivity, their ability to do things that you're not entirely sure that you can do, or just having a person who you are always either trailing very closely behind or you're hoping to always feel like you can get in front of them. If this is an impulse that is particularly important for women, as I think we still struggle culturally to have a framework for understanding women's ambition.
Okay, Marcia, I know you were kind of joking about you having a nemesis, but I now really want to know if you have one. Especially in academia, I feel like that could be a really fruitful industry for nemesis.
So, to be honest, I kind of had one in high school, but it was more of a joke because there was someone in high school who was so ridiculously accomplished. It was kind of a joke because there's no way that I could ever surpass this person's accomplishments. Like, there's too much nurture involved in this person's brilliance that I didn't have access to. So I no longer care. But I actually find that because academia is so relentless in its level of competition, and because there's so few women of color like myself in academia, that I have no nemeses presently.
Oh, wow.
And actually, I've been very, very fortunate. A lot of my friends from graduate school in our extended network, I think we were really intentional to not set that up because the system is so rigged already that we didn't want to exacerbate it with competition. But with that being said, there are some really, really dynamic and successful women that I probably see more as role models, women who I think are really good about being clear and advocating for themselves. And I've been fortunate to actually be steeped, I think, in a community where we resist that idea. But the hyper-competitive type A teenager that I was all about a nemesis. But I had to go to a lot of therapy to get rid of that.
So it's interesting that you kind of said, like, because there are so few women of color, like, it makes you not want to have a nemesis. But I have found it very helpful for me to peg white men as my nemeses. In fact, I think I've said this before on this podcast. In every job I've had, I've sort of made believe that I've had a nemesis, like someone who I don't wish ill on. I don't hope they do a bad job, but like maybe I think they get a little too much leeway or a little credit for their work that's not entirely deserved. And so whenever I go in to advocate for myself or whenever I'm feeling bad about myself, I'm like, what would that person do? You know, how would that person ask for a raise? Would that person apologize for missing such and such a deadline? And I have found it very helpful, especially the, like, you know, go into whatever situation with the confidence of a mediocre white man. Not saying that any of my colleagues have ever been mediocre, but putting myself in someone else's shoes or like using their accomplishments to push me to accomplish more has been helpful for me.
Yeah, I think people are just latching on to Roxanne's nemesis thought train, because, you know, we're supposed to be past that at this point, you know, in our lives. If we're, you know, a little older, if we're, you know, past our 20s or whatever, where we're not supposed to be thinking about other people, we're just supposed to be focused on our own goals. And I mean, I believe that healthy competition is fine. You know, people will motivate you to push towards your goal. I just don't think that I have anybody I care enough about to consider them a nemesis. Like, I feel like the people that I do have contempt for, because maybe they just seem to keep failing upward. I don't necessarily want what they have, and I don't want to prevent them from moving forward. I'm just kind of like, I just need to get mine. Let me just focus on myself. Let me do my own thing and I'll deal with it. I also just don't want to be able to trace any level of my success back to people that I can't stand. Like, I do not want to be able to say or to even think, I've achieved this goal out of pettiness or out of spite. You know, like, I want to have accomplished something because that's what I set out to accomplish, and that I'm good at whatever, and that, you know, this is something that I enjoy doing, and not just because, oh, I saw her over there getting this deal, book deal, so now I've got to get a book deal too. No.
I mean, I think part of it is, you know, deeply playful. And I think, though, it becomes this like proxy for sorting out other business that I don't think Roxanne Gay is actually even talking about. So it's kind of interesting. So I think because she's such a, you know, tastemaker and such a cultural figure among a certain group of people, I think sometimes she'll do something and then people take it in these directions and attribute to her, and it gets a little like weird and layered. But I do
like, what do you mean?
I just think there's sometimes like a lot of projecting, especially on Black women on Twitter, where it's like, it becomes this thing where it's like, how dare you, Roxanne Gay? You have a nemesis. And I think she's so deeply unbothered by the feedback, clearly. And so I think what it does, it helps us kind of untangle our weird ambition stuff and our weird public ambition stuff. Because I think one of the ways that women grapple with ambition in my experience, and I include myself in it, is that you're always afraid that people will think you're up to something, but you are up to something because you're trying to take care of yourself and you're trying to succeed. Mm-hmm. And I think for many years, I thought that if I was really transparent about how difficult it was for me to achieve things or how many times I had to, you know, kind of pick myself up from rejection, then people would be comfortable with my ambition. And I had to grow out of that. The desire to control how other people perceive, you know, your level of ambition is just something that is unwieldy and that you cannot control. And so I think that the nemesis conversation provides an opportunity for people to kind of, you know, deliberate on that in this way that is somewhat playful. But I think some of the reactions to it seem like something deeper is going on.
Yes. So, yeah, I want to go back to what you just said, because I think part of the problem with Roxanne talking about her nemesis is the fact that people have such a difficult time with women being silly on the internet. People do not want to admit that women are funny, that we can be funny. And so when she makes these jokes, or when anyone makes these jokes, right, then it becomes, like you said, this, what, how could this be? This isn't right.
Or like, how petty, like, of you to be nurturing this grudge, something
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes, yes. And so they take this opportunity to tear her down, or tear anybody down, but particularly Roxane Gay. She gets such a just an incredible amount of trolls in her mentions any given day. You know, she can't even, the slightest thing that she talks about, someone is like, why aren't you talking about children starving across the world? And it's like, just let me have a moment to be silly. So there's definitely that element where people, women are not allowed to be silly on the internet unless it's like a very over the top kind of silliness. So there's this pushback against that.
I will say that my initial reaction to Roxane Gay's tweets and a couple other sort of famous or famous-ish female writers talking about their nemeses was like, you know what? You're so successful. Like, I can't even imagine the person who you would consider your nemesis. Almost like you've achieved so much. But then, like, the more I thought about it, it felt powerful to watch somebody who I consider at the top of their field an enormous success, like probably making a legit living, if not, you know, very wealthy or whatever, admitting that they still envy people or sometimes are, you know, still striving even if they've attained this sort of conventional success. And I feel like admitting a nemesis can also be admitting that you sometimes feel insecurity, or it seems humble to admit that you want someone else's success or someone else's life. I mean, this is sort of discounting the part of the nemesis that's like, maybe they actually did something shitty to you one time, which is a whole nother kind of nemesis, which I also have some of those. Yeah. But I won't say they pushed me to do better.
Yeah, I have people who've done something against me that I will never forget. But yeah, I feel like that's different.
Taylor Lorenz at The Atlantic recently wrote a big piece about nemesis, you know, sort of pegged to everyone talking about Roxane Gay's tweets, but also talking about how nemesis or rivals can function in different industries. And she mentioned that social media platforms may also be feeding into the idea that, you know, people have more things than you, or have the life you want, or are getting all of these opportunities and you know, living their best lives, and you're just sort of watching them do this, and everyone presents their best self on the interweb. And as a sort of foil to that piece, I read a piece that my colleagues Heather Schwedell and Shannon Palace wrote in Slate about LinkedIn as the sort of low-key ultimate feeling bad about yourself social network, because it's not like everyone's putting these like beautifully filtered infinity pool photos of themselves on LinkedIn. It's just like a very cut and dry freaking resume, and you can draw your own conclusions from that. And so they said, my colleagues, I was very surprised to learn that they like regularly stalk people on LinkedIn and compare their own resumes to those people's resumes and think about like, oh, isn't it like amazing that this person who's 5 years younger than me has already surpassed me? And I mean, that piece hit me hard because although I've never stalked anyone on LinkedIn, I have had the impulse when I like read a really amazing piece of writing or see somebody achieving something incredible that maybe I want to be like, is that person younger than me? You know, like it tapped into this part of myself that I am not proud of and don't like, which is the impulse to constantly compare myself to other people. And I wonder if that's just if that's unique to journalism because everyone's accomplishments are so out there, or if that's something that happens in other industries too.
Oh, this is like the foundation of what I do for a living, of like comparison and like palace intrigue as to how person got this. You know, as an academic, and again, as like part of Black professor social media, there's a really actually interesting thing that I've noticed. So a lot of students of color, graduate students of color, first generation students, as well as academics of color, like we use Twitter a lot to share our accomplishments, and I'm among them. And then mm-hmm. there's this like other backlash Twitter, like, how dare you? Like, why are you bragging about your accomplishments in an era in which there's, you know, precarity in academia and people aren't getting fellowships and people aren't getting jobs. People aren't getting into PhD programs. And I think that this is where the kind of convergence of race and gender really mark themselves. I couldn't imagine a person of color not announcing on Twitter something that's happening. And you don't even have to like that person. You're just happy that one of us got something. Because I think one of the things I always say is that if you were in Washington, D.C. and you went up to a lawyer and said, do you know all the lawyers? The person would look at you and be like, why would you ask me such a ridiculous question? But if you asked me if I know all the Black women who are teaching at the top 40 programs in my field, I could probably name most of them, and most of them are my Facebook friends. And so when you are in these communities that are so small and achievement for one does feel like achievement for all, I think that it is important to share that. And so there's this really interesting way that, again, like the kind of, you know, the corollary to this kind of LinkedIn stalking is that, yeah, social media platforms provide an opportunity to celebrate. But I think sometimes people outside of the circles think that the individual is celebrating themselves. But it's so deep. It's like that one advisor who thought you were smart enough to like go to a master's program. And then it's like, you know, it was like me staying up with you to write your PhD, like, you know, application. And then, you know, that one other professor of color in that other department who got you so excited to apply for an NSF grant. Like, these things are really deep. And so I really bristle every time I see people say like, oh, academia Twitter, you're just a bunch of show offs. And I'm like, you have no idea how happy it makes me, you know, when some student that I don't even know is like, I got into a PhD program. I'm the first person in my family to go to college. Like, those things matter. And so I would hate that if this conversation about, you know, whatever on social media undermines people's real, like, sense of collective joy, even in this impersonal way of accomplishment and achievement.
Yeah. So working in media, there's a lot of overlap with publishing, right? Because so many of us really are, you know, maybe our main goal is to be this published writer with the novels and the nonfiction and whatever out there. So for me, when I see that another Black woman has gotten a book deal, that's amazing. That's great because that could potentially help me as well. But I'm also taking note because I know that I will be compared to that person, right? So even, you know, like, I'm in the process of sending out a book proposal. And when the first rounds of feedback came back, I was being compared to several other Black women writers. And that makes you feel strange. It gives you, you know, it was very obvious that they were just making these comparisons because I was a Black woman. Our style of writing is completely different. You know, that kind of, it just didn't work for me. So those kinds of comparisons also give you just that little, I don't know, they give you a little prick of competition. You know, they give you that little bit of, oh, well, if I have to be compared to this person, let me see what she's doing. And, oh, I can be better than that. So, you know, there is that kind of thing that happens a little bit. So I do understand the purpose of having nemeses and like where that can come from and the origin story of all of those things. But then I just try my best to pull back. And again, if someone hasn't done anything direct to me, I'm more able to move on. But if someone has definitely try to stop my bag, as the youth say, then I do have a problem.
I have never heard that before. Thank you for bringing the
youth lingo. Oh my God, it's all about the bag. My students say that to me when I get something. Like, Professor Chatelain, you secured the bag. And I was like, yes. I think that's good. Thank you.
Wait. Please explain to me, like, what,
like the
stopping,
bag of cash,
securing
right? The bag. The bag is your money, your career advancement, whatever.
I was thinking like airline luggage, like lost the bag somehow.
No, a student even referred to President Obama as securing the bag with the 2008 election.
So like the bag of, you know, with the actual like dollar sign, like
this. Got it. Like the emoji.
Right. So yes. So you secure the bag, you've got it. If someone tries to stop your bag, that means they're putting in roadblocks preventing you from getting to the bag.
That seems like a good place to stop. Yes. I'm glad that two people older than me have just taught me what the youths are saying. That makes me feel incredibly old. Listeners, please tell us who your nemeses are or why you don't have a nemesis. Our email is thewaves@slate.com. All right. The country music industry is currently enmeshed in a conversation about women's representation, especially older women's representation. Nicole, give us the lowdown.
Okay. University of Southern California's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, which is a part of their journalism school, recently released a study about women in country music. So after researching 5 years of Billboard's year-end hot country list, which was 500 songs, they discovered that there were only 16% of the singers who were female, and that there was only 12% of women songwriters on the list, which is a significant problem considering how strong the country music industry is, how those songs are always like going someplace. Country music radio is hot. Okay. It really
is. Yeah, I think
is.
It's at, like, the top genre in the country for right. listenership.
Right. So to have such, not even 1/5 of the songs that we're hearing on the radio be by women, that's a major problem, especially when you have acts like Carrie Underwood, Miranda Lambert, Kacey Musgraves, things like that. And not only are there so few women represented on these lists, but the average age of women in country music is 29 years old. The average age of men in country music is 42 years old. So basically, once women hit 30, they disappear from country music radio, which is just a shame. And it's also deliberate. The men who run the country music stations, the DJs, do not play women on the air. And if you don't hear the women on air, you're not going to go out and buy their albums. So it's a major problem that's happening right now. And once you dovetail that with Lil Nas X and his song Old Town Road, Lil Nas X is a rapper who recently released a country music song, and it was shooting up the country music charts. Billboard took it off of the charts because they said it did not have enough country music elements, and they would not explain what country music elements were missing from the song. I mean, it had a guitar, it was talking about horses,
a banjo. I
mean,
I think,
it was just
two.
Yeah, it's a banjo. I mean, it is. It sounds like a country music song.
And maybe we can play a little clip of it.
Yeah, so then what Lil Nas X did was go out and ask Billy Ray Cyrus to join him on the remix. And once again, it shot up to number one. It's doing incredibly well. So country music is having some kind of moment right now where they're dealing with their discrimination, their bigoted practices being put on blast. They're sexist and racist, and they have to have some kind of reckoning. And so that's what's going on in country music right now.
Woof. This was honestly surprising for me as a sort of a new listener to country to hear, because Kacey Musgraves was sort of my entree into country music. I've always sort of felt alienated by it for mostly political reasons, I would say. I know, you know, country is a very broad genre, but generally I've felt like it represents a culture that I don't subscribe to. And there's, I don't really see myself represented in the average country song. But then everyone's like, yo, you have to listen to Kacey Musgraves. Kacey Musgraves, I really enjoy. And, you know, she just like swept the Grammys. I'm kind of thinking like, all of the top country stars that I'm aware of are women, or most of them are women. And then to hear that they're so underrepresented on the radio and in the charts was really surprising to me. And I know there are some things you alluded to, Nicole, like there was a sort of a scandal that went beyond country music and into the mainstream news in, I think, 2015, where a country radio consultant was found to be telling radio hosts, you know, don't play two songs by women back to back. Women don't want to hear that, because women actually make up a small majority of country music listeners. You know, there's this idea out there that women don't want to hear other women sing. But I still kind of felt like, you know, women were highly represented in country. So now I'm wondering, you know, is this, I know it's a cycle, like any business, where, especially in music or film and TV, where companies give consumers what they think they want and in turn shape the desires of those consumers so they want what they're being given. But I also wonder if it has to do with the demographics of country music listeners. I did a little bit of research, and I learned that they skew older than most other genres. Like, as you go up the age brackets, more and more people say that country music is their favorite genre. And I wonder if that has something to do with it. Like, are older people more used to or wanting to hear more men sing? I don't know.
Something that I've kind of come to in recent years is that when we talk about gender disparities in representation, so much of that conversation now is adjacent to like tech and STEM and Silicon Valley and certain levels of business, that we often exempt the softer side or the more humanities-based industries as, well, they probably don't have a gender problem because it's writing, it's singing, it's making music. But I think increasingly these stories remind us that gender disparities are everywhere in terms of places in which people can influence culture and have the power to generate a lot of income. So it's this kind of strange thing that, you know, again, soft fields, allegedly soft field, you know, like art history, U.S. history. It's like, okay, there's probably an equal representation. But again, as people rise up the ranks and consolidate more power, there are just fewer and fewer women represented. And so I think that this country music conversation is really illustrative, that even in places where you have incredible icons, it makes you take a step back and say, wait a second, the women who are represented are at the very, very top. And then there's just a bunch of dudes just kind of like taking up space in the kind of rest of the field, so that you're either like Dolly Parton or some like loser who can get onto the Billboard charts guy. It's this weird kind of thing to think about.
Blake Shelton is going to be really pissed at you, Marcia.
I'm not talking about Blake Shelton, but you know,
no, I know
the other. But what I'm saying is, this like what it takes for a woman to be a notable in a field that is, you know, it's entertainment, it's highly feminized, it's country, it's love songs, it's, you know, all of these things. This was actually really eye opening and really helpful for me to really think about scrutinizing places in which I assume there shouldn't be a gender imbalance.
Huh.
So I am from Nashville, which is, you know, home of country music, Music City, USA. So I have been dealing with, I've been seeing this stuff all my life from country music. And, you know, I can't say that I particularly love country music. It's not the genre that I go to, but I do like country music. You kind of have to, or you either have to end up hating it when you grow up in Nashville. But what country music does, I think, to speak to this idea, the older demographics, I think it is a fantasy, right? In the same way that, you know, in hip hop, you have the men who are bragging about the things that they've accomplished with whatever, guns, drug dealings, fights, whatever, whatever. Country music has those same elements of fantasy for older generations, where life is a little simpler. Mm. Your problems were easier when all you just had to deal with was making ends meet and getting married or finding the right person to settle down with. And of course, that right person is the opposite gender, right? So it's very easy for older people to just remember to sit and listen to country music and not have to worry about making sure they're being PC, which is like the poison that seeps into their minds, right? Like, I don't want to have to deal with thinking about other people, whatever. So that's part of it. And that's part of why country music, the women need to be younger and prettier, because it speaks to that fantasy life of just, you know, you're out on your tractor and you come home to a pretty young thing who's going to fix, you know, some skillet cornbread for you. And that's all you need is your woman and your beer and your dog on the porch.
But women also love country music. And I wonder if, like, maybe the way women listen to country is like wanting to be the subject or object of the song, you know, having a man sing about how much they love them, whatever. And men maybe want to identify more with the singer, to be the one with the pickup truck and looking at this cutie in her, you know, denim cutoffs or whatever.
Right. And so when female country music artists started to sing about men doing them wrong in a particular way, and they weren't the victims anymore, they were getting revenge, and female country music singers began to be angry, that's part of the problem. I think you know, when you've got the Dixie Chicks talking about Goodbye Earl, which is, you know, a song about killing Earl after the things that he's done, that, you know, and Dixie Chicks mouthed off about
George Bush.
You know, you've got Shania Twain, who was like, I'm not going to fit into your box of what a country music woman should look like or talk about or sing about, rather. You know, you have all these women who started to push back a little bit. And I don't know, I don't think country music really, the men who rule country music, they didn't like that. And so I think that what we're looking at is the result of those punishments, you know, when women, the women in country music were changing with the times, and men just did not, the men in the positions of power did not appreciate that. And so that's when they have that thing where, like, you know, sprinkle the women's songs on the radio like tomatoes in a salad, which became the tomato
oh,
gate,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. So it's just really, really interesting, because you also have a song like Beyonce's Daddy Lessons from Lemonade, which Billboard refused to put as a honor as a country music song. Country music did not want to acknowledge it as a country music song. When she performed, I think she performed at the Grammys or either the Country Music Awards with the Dixie Chicks, they did not put that video up online. Usually they, you know, post certain clips online for people to go back and look at the performances. They refused. They also, if you find it and you look at the camera work, you know, the camera just kind of stayed away from Beyonce as much as possible, and, you know, kept going to the Dixie Chicks and things like that. So it's a very deliberate thing, and there's no rational excuse for it other than racism and sexism. You know, they're just afraid of what these older white men who listen to country music are going to think about this stuff.
And I also wonder if that the worldview of country music sort of inherently politicizes women and people of color, such that, like, their very existence as the creator or main artist of a country song makes the song seem political, even if it isn't.
You know, it's interesting because country music artists, male country music artists, can experiment with the genre of country music, right? So you've got Brad Paisley, who can put LL Cool J on a track called Accidental
Racist.
Oh my
God, that's,
and it's okay.
and it's so terrible.
It's a terrible
song. The worst thing that's ever happened to America.
It's a terrible song, but, you know, nobody blinked. It's still a country music song, however controversial it was. That was fine. Then you have back in the, I can't remember, in the 90s, late 90s, maybe early aughts, Trace Atkins had a song called The Honky Tonk Badonkadonk.
Oh, I remember this. Second worst thing that happened to America.
Badonkadonk was black slang for a huge butt, right? And Trace Atkins, a country music singer, decided he was going to...
Who's white?
Yes, he's white. he made this song called Honky Tonk Badonka Donk about white country girls with big butts. And it was fine. You know, I think, you know, he was like talking a little bit. He wasn't rapping, I don't think. But like, you know, he was singing and stuff like that. So you have these moments where white men in country music can experiment and step outside and try to expand whatever. You have something like Florida Georgia Line, you know, and the way that bro country has changed a little bit of what we expect from country music. That's fine. But as soon as women do it, or as soon as people of color try to get their way in, then it's a problem. And country music needs to figure out what do they want? Do they want to just leave all this money on the table, you know, for their ideals? Or do they just want to like open up the world, open up their worlds to accept that there are lots of people who love country music?
Yeah. Listeners, I would love to hear some of your favorite female country stars or songwriters. Please send us some good songs if you know them. TheWaves@Slate.com is where you can find us. Okay, it's time for our recommendations. Who wants to go first?
I will go first.
Great.
My recommendation this week is the book Sex Workers, Psychics, and Number Runners, Black Women in New York City's Underground Economy by LaShawn Harris. This is a fascinating look at the various ways that African-American women made ends meet in Harlem and throughout New York City. And it really focuses on some characters that you all want to know about because they're fascinating, especially Madame Stephanie St. Clair, a numbers runner who made the mob shake in their boots and was able to capitalize from the underground economy that kept Black New York running.
That sounds really good. Yeah. Nicole.
So April is National Poetry Month, so I would like to recommend a poetry collection, an anthology called All We Know of Pleasure, Poetic Erotica by Women. And the editor is Enid Schomer. That's E-N-I-D Schomer, S-H-O-M-E-R. And it is a beautiful collection of women poets who are talking about sex and pleasure and erotica. It's just a beautiful collection of poetry. And I mean, there are people like Anne Sexton, Nikki Giovanni. Oh, gosh, just a lot of people in it. I highly recommend it. Even if you think that you're not into poetry, please pick it up. So it's called All We Know of Pleasure.
I love that you looped in National Poetry Month. I had no idea it was National Poetry Month. I am recommending an episode of the Slate podcast Decoder Ring. I try not to recommend too much Slate stuff on here because I don't want it to seem like I'm obsessed with us. But this episode is so good. It came out, I want to say, last month. It's about truck nuts, the little plastic testicles that some people put on the back of their trucks. The Decoder Ring host Willa Paskin and producer Ben Frisch look into the history of truck nuts as a company and as a cultural product. The journey that they go on is fascinating. They talk to a couple truck nuts customers. I think they're a little too friendly to the truck nuts phenomenon at the end. I think they drank the, you know, proverbial Kool-Aid a little bit. But I found it really interesting. I am completely baffled by the concept of truck nuts, and I highly recommend it for a listen. It made me laugh out loud multiple times, which I don't usually do while listening to a podcast. So that's my high endorsement of the show. All right, that's our episode for the week. Thank you to our production assistant, Alex Barish, and our producer, Danielle Hewitt. For Marcia Chatlin and Nicole Perkins, I'm Christina Cotterucci. Thanks for listening.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.